thank you all for coming. I think I should apologize, first of all, that I don't have any knowledge of Arabic, and so I must address you in English, and those of you who understand it must wear these dreadful headphones and have a translation. So I'm sorry for that. The second thing I must do is thank Mohammed Haeckel for his kindness and hospitality in bringing me here and looking after me so well, and his achievement in setting up this foundation, which is really quite extraordinarily valuable, I think, in trying to promote the voice of independent journalism. Independent journalism is often quite a small voice in the world, and I've had that feeling from time to time during what's been quite a long career in British journalism, that what we try and do doesn't make a loud voice most of the time. Just sometimes it does make a loud voice. And however small the voice of independent journalism, it's always a voice that is listened to somewhere, and I think it's a voice that's absolutely fundamental for the political health of a society, for the society in which journalists work. Without the voice of independent journalism, small or large, I think it's not possible for a society to correct itself. And if there's one lesson of history, it's that societies go adrift very frequently, and they need to be corrected very frequently. The kind of journalism that I do and that we do on The Guardian in London, I like to think is helping to provide a self-correcting mechanism for the society in which I live. So that's a rather sort of philosophical word or two about what I do, and I'm not really a philosopher. What I really am is a practitioner, and I do this stuff. And over the last few days, I've been talking to my young Egyptian colleagues about how I do this stuff and how they do this stuff. The world from which I come is a world where, to be honest with you, there has been a bit of a crisis of corruption in the UK in recent years. The Al Yamama scandal, to which Hani Shukrulla referred, has really not improved Britain's image in the world, because what has happened over a period of about 5 years now is that we journalists in Britain have slowly, bit by bit, uncovered a trail of corruption which has stretched across the world. Al Yamama, the dove, the arms contract with Saudi Arabia, and a British arms company, BAE, is only part of a very large network of arms deals across the world, which we have discovered have taken place, and taken place over decades. And these arms deals have been accompanied by massive secret payments. I would say bribes is an appropriate word for many of them. What we have uncovered is trails of literally billions of British pounds being paid through offshore companies into Swiss banks, and going into the pockets of agents and fixers, and sometimes going into the pockets of politicians. It's a world that's not confined to Britain, and I'm afraid that all the major arms companies of the Western world have been discovered at one time or another to have been involved in corrupt practices. Corrupt practices are inseparable, I guess, from the business of arms dealing. What has been particularly embarrassing, though, about the Al Yamama scandal is that my own country and my own government have closed down the investigations into what we journalists uncovered. We had the extraordinary sensation that we wrote story after story about these secret payments all over the world by one of the world's biggest arms companies. Our allegations were eventually taken up by a British police agency, the Serious Fraud Office, who set about trying to investigate them further. When they were on the brink of making an investigative breakthrough, they were seeking some Swiss bank accounts into which the British company had paid, we understand, £1 billion over the years, they were stopped, and their investigations were stopped by the then British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, who, in a move which has been quite shocking to me and to others, how shall I put this, interfered with British justice. He demanded that the case be closed down because it was bad for business, because it was upsetting the Saudi regime, because Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia, who was involved, had protested and objected. Now, in a way, I suppose it's flattering to a journalist that when they write stories, they have such dramatic international consequences. I mean, to tell you the truth, I've never written a story which had such dramatic consequences. But these consequences were not good for the political health of the country I live in. And I don't think they've been good for the reduction of corruption worldwide. Now, I mean, this isn't, of course, the only corruption problem that we face in my own country. We have running crises and scandals about political donations, the award of honours. Only this week, as I left London for Cairo, the newspapers, including my own, were full of stories of how Russian oligarchs, Russian billionaires, were being approached by British politicians in the hope that they would give them money, which I should say is illegal in Britain. And that is all rumbling on. There are many, many other cases of corruption that come to light in the UK. Just to name a couple of examples. Recently, a subsidiary of the giant American company Halliburton, its chief executive of its London subsidiary, was put in jail in the United States. And what emerged was that a lawyer in London had been carrying bribes from the construction company to officials in Nigeria. Another case just come to light. An international British construction firm, Balfour Beatty, has just paid a civil penalty of £2 million for what were described as accounting irregularities in the role they played in the construction of the Alexandria Library here in Egypt 7 or 8 years ago. So I don't want to come here and talk about corruption as though corruption is a local problem here, as though it's a problem in Egypt, that it's a problem in the Arab world, and it's not a problem in the British world, it's not a problem in the Western world. It is absolutely a universal problem. I think in every society in the world, we find that the rich and the powerful attempt to write their own rules. This is familiar with you, I'm sure. You know, there are several cases that I hear about in Egypt in which, you know, rich men are accused of attempting to write their own rules. Now, what I've been trying to say over the last few days is that the role of independent journalists is to try and expose this sort of corruption. And I wanted to focus for a minute or two on how difficult it is. We've been talking about that here in the workshop sessions here. It's very difficult to expose bribery and corruption, even more difficult than to expose other sorts of crime. The reasons are governments are often involved. The facts of what went on are invariably concealed behind complicated veils and layers. And when you are dealing with issues such as international arms contracts, you're dealing with things which are secret. governments keep them secret, companies keep them secret, they talk about national security. More veils that it's almost impossible to penetrate. There are other specific difficulties about reporting on corruption in a society where censorship exists. There are also difficulties about reporting in societies like my own, where the economic basis for independent journalism is actually evaporating before my eyes. The world in which I grew up as a journalist, in which quite a lot of people paid quite a lot of money to buy newspapers, and quite a lot of advertisers paid money too, and the newspapers were then distributed around the country. This is evaporating before our eyes. It's disappearing, and it's disappearing in the United States. Everything is migrating to the internet. The revenue base is disappearing. The kind of journalism required to investigate corruption is expensive. It's uncertain. It's expensive not only of cash, but of manpower. It's also expensive in the sense that it can provoke reaction, legal actions, the kind of things that are very expensive to defend. In that kind of commercial environment, investigative journalism that's going to expose corruption is taking more and more of a back seat. However, I think that's more of a problem for me than it is for you. I think something different is happening in the excessively mature markets or senile markets in Britain and the UK. Maybe that's not the problem here. Maybe the problem here is finding out, is having enough outlets to write what needs to be written. Now, those are the negative things, but there are some positive things. And what is happening to the world, as we all know, is that it's becoming globalized. And that means that many, many transactions of many kinds don't happen inside national boundaries. They happen across boundaries. Now, what's true of ordinary commerce is doubly true of bribery and corruption. Bribery is something that's very frequently global. I'll give you just a couple of examples. When we were working on the Al-Yamama business and we were trying to obtain evidence of the secret payments that were being made by BAE, we discovered, and this is a real example, we discovered secret commissions that were being paid by BAE in London, but they weren't coming from BAE. They were going to a secret subsidiary set up by BAE in the Caribbean, in the British Virgin Islands, where company secrecy flourishes. From the company in the British Virgin Islands, the payments were going to a company registered in Panama, and this was owned by an agent. And this Panama company then had an account actually in a Swiss bank in Geneva. The money that went to the Swiss bank was then transferred back across the ocean to a bank in Jersey, in the Channel Isles, just offshore from London, where, funnily enough, this money started its long journey. And from there, the money went to a politician in Africa, in Tanzania. So that's a very long journey taken by that money across several jurisdictions. And the striking thing about it is that that's not unusual, that's normal. These activities cross borders, not just in the way that country A sells to country B, but that all the money involved and the bribes involved, if bribes there are, involve numerous countries. The same goes for, I was talking about donations, the same goes for that kind of thing, payments to politicians, payments to political parties. For example, if you read the biography in English of Prince Bandar bin Sultan, who is an influential figure in Saudi Arabia, someone we had a good deal to do with investigating over the Al-Yamama BAE affair, one of the most striking recollections in his biography, something that he told the author, obviously, was about the way he secretly funded the Italian elections in the 1980s. he tells the most extraordinary story, really. He says, now, this is a prince in Saudi Arabia. He was ambassador in Washington. He goes to Washington. He says he meets with Mrs. Thatcher, who was then prime minister. He meets with President Bush. And they tell him that they would like a secret donation to be made to the Christian Democrats in Italy so that they won the election. And he says, he puts $10 million in a suitcase and he goes and he flies to Rome and he hands it over to these politicians. So just that simple story involves, you know, what, Saudi, Washington, Rome, three countries. And there's nothing unusual about that. Just as trade crosses borders, so corruption crosses borders. That's my very simple point. Journalism has lagged behind in dealing with this. We journalists in London, and I suspect here in Egypt as well, tend to have very local fixations, you know. How does this affect Britain? Or we send a foreign correspondent to a place like this, they stay here, they publish reports from an Egyptian perspective. It's very rare to have joined-up journalism, and it's something that I think it's vital to develop if we're to go to the next level in exposing the kind of cross-border corruption and the kind of cross-border crime which is increasingly becoming normal in the world. Journalists have got to cross borders too. That's my point. Cross-border journalism is a term that was actually invented by a colleague of mine in Washington, Chuck Lewis, who used to be a very distinguished program producer on CBS. And about 10 years ago, he started to try and put together networks of international journalists, investigative journalists, who could cooperate. People from different organizations who could come together and work on international projects. And when we were doing the Al Yamamah investigations, which went on for years and years, we found that gradually we too, on The Guardian in London, were pushed into finding and making links with other journalists in other countries. And we quite deliberately, normally, journalists are pretty rivalrous, you know. Cooperation is foreign to their natures. But we found that we could make this work. We would go to a journalist in Sweden, for example, a TV journalist with Frederick Lorin, and we would say, you've got a common, your plane company, Saab, has got a common marketing arrangement with the British plane company, BAE. And they have been selling planes into all kinds of countries jointly where there are allegations of bribery. Now, why don't you investigate this? And I'll tell you what, we are willing to give you the documents we've got. We are willing to put you in touch with the witnesses you've got. That worked pretty well. The Swedes did their own investigations. They've got their own connections over there. They unearthed all kinds of surprising things. They made a rather powerful television program, caused a bit of a furore in Sweden. The prosecutor in Stockholm began his own investigation into BAE. That was sort of how it worked. We did the same thing in Romania, for example, where it turned out there were allegations that large secret payments had been made in order to cement the sale of some old frigates to Romania. We identified the agent there. I went out to Bucharest. I made contact with a Romanian journalist, and he was able to pick up the story, use his own contacts, find out things I couldn't find out, you know, like the agent was married to someone who had been had very strong connections with the old communist apparatchik, something I was totally unaware of. He wrote stories in Romania. The whole thing caused a Romanian investigation to begin. And in this way, we found that we were actually running a sort of international network of investigators, which had grown up and pretty well on its own, You know, it just happened accidentally. And the culmination of the investigation into Al-Yamama was really some exposures that we perpetrated about Prince Bandar, the man I mentioned who went around with the $10 million in a suitcase. It culminated in us revealing that he had had £1 billion in total over the years from BAE in the context of this arms deal. And to publish that story, we joined forces with the BBC. We joined forces with the Panorama program on the BBC and its reporter, Jane Corbyn. They're an organization with as much or even more credibility than us internationally. That was one of the reasons why we wanted to do it. Another reason, to be frank with you, was we were a bit scared at the scale of what we were discovering. And I think we wanted some moral support for what we were doing. In the way of journalism, cooperation doesn't always succeed. And that is an example where actually cooperation broke down a bit because the story was so huge, the exposure was so huge, that in the end I think we fell to quarrelling about who was going to reveal it first, and we had an unseemly squabble in which both sides claimed that we'd thought of this first and we'd revealed it to the world. I don't think it was a squabble that was very important in the big scheme of things. What was important was that by jointly publishing this material, it was taken seriously by the rest of the world. And the upshot of that story was that thanks to our cooperative efforts, a globalized police effort began. Not only did the Swedes begin an investigation, but the Swiss began an investigation. And after our exposures of the Bandar payments, which had gone through a bank in Washington, the Department of Justice in Washington took up the case and is now conducting its own investigation, and indeed was arresting and questioning BAE executives quite recently when they touched down on American soil. So what we've seen is that by internationalizing our work, we've not only given it new depth, but we've actually given a new stimulus to criminal investigations, if you like, by the real investigators, because we journalists are not the real investigators because we don't have the powers, you know. We're only the people who can point the finger and say, something was wrong here, something smells bad here. But it worked, and it's been my experience that over and again, this kind of cross-border cooperation is beginning to work, that... And I wonder whether journalists here, for example, wouldn't do well to try and find ways in which they can make links with other investigative journalists in other parts of the world. The reason I suggest that is not purely because it gives extra strength to a story. It's because we find in Britain, and I'm sure you find in Egypt, that some stories are too dangerous to run. For different reasons. It may be that there are legal restrictions. It may be that the proprietor of a paper for which you work isn't going to allow you to run a story. All kinds of reasons why sometimes a story is just too hot to run. And I think this especially applies to stories about corruption and crime that have a political dimension. I've found in the past that we used to write stories about intelligence matters, for example, and I remember that on one occasion there was one which was simply, it was simply been a blatant breach of the British Official Secrets Act, which protects national security, if we had published the story. And I went and found a colleague from an Israeli newspaper, there was an Israeli angle to this story, and I gave it to him. And he then published it in Israel, because although the Israeli censorship is pretty fierce about things they care about, they didn't care about this one. Once he'd published it, I was then able to publish it in Britain. I could say to the authorities, look, it's in the public domain, it's been made public, I'm not revealing any secrets, you can't very well stop us. rather similar experience, which I mentioned in the workshops, when we were looking into this Tanzanian business in which very large payments, 30% of the contract price, were sent by a circuitous route to Tanzania. At one point in the investigation, I got on a plane and I went to Dar es Salaam, and I got hold of local journalists and said, who's the agent? Who's the intermediary in all this? Do you know? And they said, yes, of course we know. And they told me his name. And I said, well, you know, why haven't you published any of this? And they said, oh, we can't possibly do that. You know, the people who own the papers wouldn't let us because they're like that with the local politicians. But they said, tell you what, you go back to London and you write the story and then in The Guardian, and then we are perfectly free to lift it and run it in our paper because we can say, look, it's not us, it's them. And that's a tactic which works over and again. This makes me feel that the future lies in formalizing these links, if it's possible. And I think that also helps to deal with the economic weakness of investigative journalists, that the things they do soak up so many resources that they can't do a good job on their own in one country. These events are too big to be dealt with within one country. And I just want to finish by mentioning three organizations which I think are relevant and are a sign of the future of the kind of journalism that sets out to expose corruption. They've all got rather similar initials, actually. One is called ICIJ, one is called GIJ, and one is called CIJ. And I'll just tell you a little bit about these. The first one, ICIJ, is the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. This is the group that was set up by Chuck Lewis in Washington, who went out and found 50 or 60 prominent investigative journalists in different countries and invited them to join this network. It's a non-profit organization. They rely on donations for a lot of their work, and I'm afraid that's becoming a model in the United States. And they've done a few really quite successful cross-border projects. The first one that I was involved in was about cigarette smuggling, when journalists from half a dozen different countries contributed to an analysis of the practices of big international tobacco companies. And there was one in particular that I was involved in, British American Tobacco, which, although based in Britain, its business consists of exporting to, 80 countries overseas, probably more. And you couldn't make sense of its activities unless you had journalists working abroad, journalists working in all these different countries. With the aid of a cache of documents that the companies had disclosed, we were able to do a massive project that really demonstrated for once, beyond contradiction, that these big international companies were not enemies of smuggling, as they used to claim, but were actively colluding and organizing smuggling, because they made just as much money from smuggled cigarettes as they did from official cigarettes. That group, ICIJ, they've done a more recent project, in fact, tobacco-related, which I was involved in just before I came here. And there, again, it was about cigarette smuggling, rather different this time. Lots of cross-border cooperation. Turned out that Russia is operating a cigarette factory, a sort of black market cigarette factory, in the strange enclave of Russian territory they now have on the Baltic Sea at Kaliningrad, which is a sort of leftover enclave, or technically an exclave, after the breakup of the Soviet Union, and it's a pretty lawless sort of place. They're manufacturing millions of cigarettes which are being sold to all comers and smuggled on the black market, and they're being smuggled to Lithuania, to Poland, to Germany, to the UK, and all over Europe. Again, this was something it proved possible to document by using the resources of half a dozen different journalists to bring into focus something that people were unaware of before. Now, that's the ICIJ. The GIJ is the Global Investigative Journalism Conference. This is a group of basically Scandinavian journalists, and the world of Scandinavia is different to the world in the Mediterranean, I think. This is funded by the Norwegian Foreign Ministry, mainly, with a few private donors as well. And the Norwegian Foreign Ministry thinks the world would be improved if there was more investigative journalism. And so they pay to hold regular conferences, and I went to the last one in Norway, in Lillehammer, where hundreds of journalists from across the world gather, compare notes, put together joint projects, try and educate each other, try and form a network which can take on the globalized networks of crime and corruption that we see all around us. And finally, the third of my little sets of initials is the CIJ. And the CIJ is the Center for Investigative Journalism. This is a small outfit based in London. It is based at City University in London, where I teach, wearing my other hat as the Anthony Sampson Professor when I'm not writing for The Guardian. And there they have a little independent center. They take on interns, they take on projects, they do training, they link up with the others. They are one of a growing number of investigative units that are sprouting up all over the world, and you know, they deal in cooperating with other people. Some of the money for all this comes from donors of the kind of George Soros, who I'm sure many of you have heard of, and it's an open question how these sorts of activities can be funded and be made to work and fit into the world of regular journalism. But what I am certain of is that we have to find a way to let these new international seeds grow, because if we don't, then the present capacity which we journalists have got for exposing a little bit of the corruption that goes on in the world is going to disappear entirely. And as I said at the beginning of this, although independent journalism can be quite a small voice, I mean, I think it's an absolutely vital voice for the health of not one society, but all our different societies. So I hope that, you know, gatherings like this, workshops like this, can become part of a globalized practice of investigative journalism that's going to make things a little bit better. That's what I have to tell you.